Welcome to Radio Sefarad's English Corner. I'm your host, Linda Jimenez, bringing news and other features of Jewish interest to Radio Sefarad's English-speaking audience in Spain and around the world. Our trivia question for this week is, why did Dan Rosenberg decide to translate the poems into Yiddish before setting them to music? Dr. Paula David is a gerontologist and social worker in Toronto, Canada. In the 1990s, while she was working at Toronto's Baycrest Center for Geriatric Care, she met a group of Holocaust survivors and realized that she would have to take a unique approach to their care. To provide a space for them to openly speak about their trauma, she created a survivors group. Paula heard their stories, which she turned into poems. Dan Rosenberg is a radio producer and presenter in Toronto. He worked on the Yiddish Glory Project, which we did a program on a few years ago. His latest project is Silent Tears, a CD of songs which are based on poetry and stories from women who survived the Holocaust, but often kept these details secret for decades. It includes some of the poetry from Paula David's project, which has been adapted into Yiddish and set to music, as well as songs inspired by the book Buried Words by Molly Applebaum, a 92-year-old survivor from Poland who was able to elude the Nazis by being hidden by a farmer buried in his barn for 2 years. This week, we're speaking with Paula and Dan about the Silent Tears project and the poetry and stories that inspired it. Payadora is a tango band based in Toronto. The music for Silent Tears was composed by their violinist, Rebecca Walkstein, and we're including links to YouTube videos of two of them and also a link to a radio documentary about Molly Applebaum.
Thank you so much for speaking with us, both of you. First, Paula, I would like it if you could tell us a little bit about how this story began 30 years ago. You were a social worker at a retirement home in Toronto, right?
Yes, I was. Actually, the Baycrest Center where I worked is a multi-service continuum of care, huge facility. And I, at that time, was in the terrace, which was supported independent living complex. And in planning for a Yom HaShoah ceremony, I had to go around and meet the various survivors that lived in the building. And I was just amazed at how many there were. About 40% of the 200 plus residents were survivors. So I called them together to discuss the ceremony, and conversations started and the group gelled. And afterwards, they said that they wished they could continue meeting, not just wait for Yom HaShoah. So we did, and that was the beginning of a survivors group and the beginning for me of a huge and life-changing journey.
How many people were involved at the beginning, and were there both men and women?
There were two men, and that just reflected the general demographic of the population. Everybody was pretty much 80 plus, and the majority of the people in the residence were women. The men eventually dropped out. So it was from then on a women's group, but never was that intentional. And at the beginning, they really wanted it. And I was really quite nervous. I am a group worker, but hadn't had a group this unique ever in my experience, nor did I have an inkling of what I was getting into and the levels of trauma and the types of experience. These women hadn't really talked that much at that point in their lives. So I have to admit, for the first year, it was the most silent group I'd ever encountered.
But they themselves wanted to continue meeting, you said.
Occasionally, I would suggest that perhaps this group might be better served in another way. We could have a coffee clutch, or we could do something else. And they insisted they wanted to keep the group and that they wanted to attend the group. And they also really didn't speak. And it did take about a year. And at one point, the dam just broke. And with one small story from one of the members everybody started talking. And everybody was just caught off guard with this wave of information. It turns out I wasn't the only one not hearing many of these stories for the first time. They all knew their own experiences intimately, but didn't realize the vast array of experience that happened, traumatic and horrible experience that happened to each and every one of them. So we were on our way.
I think that it's, or it was, very common for survivors not to want to talk about their experiences.
Yes. And at that time, this was the first cohort of aging survivors, the first group of the survivor population around the world that was reaching old age, and age-related issues were coming into their complex picture of experience. So there was a small group of us around the world working with this age group and talking to each other, but we really were walking into uncharted territory and learning new ways of supporting people and listening and working with them.
How did you facilitate the discussions, or is it just that they spoke spontaneously?
No, I asked questions. I would ask hard questions sometimes. They were very good at self-protection. If it was going to be too challenging for them, they had a post-war lifetime of protecting themselves. I guess the hard part was making them feel safe and comfortable, and that evolved over time. What happened, though, they were much stronger and much more aware of the trauma challenges than I was. This was new charted territory for me. Nothing I had learned in school prepared me for this level of storytelling and narratives and experience of so many people. So I was the one that was often at a loss. And I have to admit, I understood that first year of silence was not so much about protecting themselves, but they were taking care of me. Once I understood that, I had more confidence moving forward. And the poems happened because I knew I was hearing something quite unique and special and magical, and I didn't quite know what to do with it all. And I asked permission and got it to tape the group session so that I could listen to it afterwards and think on it more in between the sessions. So that was how I got the tapes. And that's how the poetry project began, because themes started coming out.
Tell us about the themes and how you turned them into poems.
Well, there were several themes, main themes of severe pain, of coping with loss, disbelief, a lot of post-war trauma in itself that they shared in common, no matter what country they came from or what country they went to. They had new unforeseen difficulties because they were this unique group called Holocaust survivors, and they had their different experiences in common. So when they talked about any particular theme, I would be hearing 12 to 18, depending how many individuals were in the room, themes and stories on that particular item. And I started pulling out sentences and pulling out lines verbatim and putting them into a thematic perspective, just helping me sort out what I was hearing. And then I would go back and called it a poem and read it to them. And they said, "That's amazing. That's exactly how I feel. Who wrote that? Where did you find that? Because that's the truth." And then I explained, "Well, I found it here. It's what you said." And they all said, "No, my English isn't good enough. I couldn't say that. I don't speak that well." And then they started recognizing their own sentences and taking great pride in it. And it just demonstrated how the power of a group was so much stronger than the power of an individual in this particular context.
What were some of the themes that they dealt with?
Loss was the big one. Loss of loved ones, loss of babies. That was one of the first shattering concepts that came up, which got everybody talking, which was so hard for me. And the fact that one person said, what they realized, two women realized they were in the same ghetto. And they said, were you there the day they came in and threw the babies out the window of the third floor? And yes, I was there. And that was my baby. And everybody started talking about their children. And none of us had heard these stories from each other up until that point. So it was somewhat like a tidal wave of release for everybody.
That must have been very difficult for you.
It was. And that is why eventually the poetry was my resource to keep me going as well, because I could work on that and pull something together and focus on the pulling together to go back to focus with them on the harder issues. And we all evolved in this process. They would check me out if I was receiving these horrific stories well enough from their perspective, they would tell me more. And eventually we all became more comfortable in dealing with hard issues. And we all knew what we were doing and that it was really hard, which made it, I think that shared experience made it doable. And eventually great pride for the group came out of this project because they recognized and they knew that they had done something important.
You briefly touched on this, but I'd like you to speak a little bit about language, because their first language was Yiddish, but they spoke with you in English and the poems are originally in English. So could you tell us a little bit about the language in the poems?
Yes, all of them, English was their second, third, fourth language, and none of them were terrifically fluent in it. They learned it later in life. But what I was hearing, their various syntax and their grammar is what made their words sound so authentic when expressing such hard feelings, because they were using the best English they had. And should I had wanted to edit it and clean it up, it never would have sounded so true and so realistic, because each one had their own syntax depending what their own original language was. I don't speak Yiddish, so they worked very hard to speak English for my sake and so that I would understand. And in the end, I felt that their English and the way they framed their words made the poetry that much more authentic. Ironically, when Dan came into the picture and eventually these were put to music and became songs and transferred to another medium, which widened and their audience, and it was years later, so a new audience, they were translated back to Yiddish, which is somehow, in my mind, divine justice occurring here. All of these women are long gone, and yet their words have gone back to their mother tongue and are being shared in their mother tongue. And it's a whole new generation of people listening to this music. So it's quite an amazing journey that their words have gone on and how their stories have survived.
Well, we'll get to that in a minute, but first tell us about the book Collective Poems. When did that come out?
Well, we put together poem after poem, and at that time I went to my supervisor and I said, we have a book here. I would love to do this. And there was no budget for that. So I went home and spoke to my teenage kids who were just learning computers, and they said we would do it together. And I was not that computer literate at the time. I didn't know about publishing programs, but they did. And so we put the book together. We did it at the Baycrest print shop. And so the staff in the print shop were pivotal in making this happen. My supervisor, who actually sat down and read them, did a complete turnaround and said, we'll make this happen as well. Don't worry about it. And we did. And interesting enough, the group was consulted all along the way. I thought they might be reticent about going public, and they were thrilled and excited. We had a big book launch and invited dignitaries across the city, and they all came and their families were there. And it was the most incredible moment for me because they were proud. They were not, there was no shame. There was no embarrassment. They spoke their truth and they were recognized for it. So the book was a landmark for all of us.
Is the book still available?
I believe there are some copies around a couple of bookstores in Toronto. I believe that Baycrest might still have a few, but we printed off X number and distributed them then. They are in libraries around the world, in Jewish libraries. Yad Vashem has at the Holocaust Memorial in Washington has them. So they're around. I'm not sure how readily available they are.
Okay, well, thank you. Dan, since Paula started talking about the Silent Tears Project, I would like it if you could elaborate a little bit more. After so many years, where did the idea come from and whose idea was it?
So the project essentially began, I think it was 2019. We had a concert with another group I'm involved in called Yiddish Glory, which you featured on your radio program, about songs written during the Holocaust, primarily in Ukraine and Moldova, about experiences of Jewish victims and survivors and Jewish soldiers in the Red Army. And after that concert, Paul and I started talking, and she mentioned her poetry project. And at the time, I was working on a follow-up album based on stories of Holocaust survivors here in Toronto. And I was just blown away by these poems because they hit you on so many levels. On one hand, they are these accounts of what happened, stories that aren't often shared. But I think even most importantly, I think the average person who's not in this field, in medical care, social work, dealing with post-traumatic stress, don't realize the consequences of what it is like as a child living through horrors like this, living through war, and how even after you come to Canada, even if it's 20, 40, 60, 80 years later, this pain, these traumas are so real. And during the pandemic, we worked on setting these poems to music with an amazing team of musicians led by Rebecca Wolkstein, who composed most of the music for these poems.
How did you get the idea to translate them back into Yiddish, and who did that?
Well, part of it is just as a Yiddish band, having singers that could do this sort of work. Also, just the beauty of Yiddish, the idea of, we wanted to sing these songs also as tangos, Yiddish tangos, which were very popular in Eastern Europe at that time. Poland was the capital of European tango, and most of the composers in the 1920s and 30s were Jewish. And sadly, most of them were killed by the Nazis during the Holocaust. So the idea was to recreate the sound and try to have it as if, what the type of music, in since most of this was in Poland, would have sounded like back then. We worked with two translators, Vicky Ash and Alexander Fish. Both of them live in Israel. And if you're a Yiddish speaker, the lyrics are just stunning. And I think even they did such a beautiful job that even if you don't know Yiddish, if you're not reading the subtitles on the videos, it still really touches you.
Now, the Silent Tears Project just came out this year, and all of the survivors have died already. And I was wondering if you have had any feedback from any of their children or grandchildren?
Well, one key member of the project is still alive, Molly Applebaum. She's not involved with Paula's poetry project, but she's a survivor who lives in North Toronto and wrote a book about her experience in hiding. She's now 92. And during the war, her mother had arranged for a place for her to hide. And her mother found a farmer who would hide two girls, Molly and her older cousin, them in a barn, worried that the neighbors might see that he was hiding Jews. And they were in this barn for more than 2 years, had to deal with the cold, the filth, the abuse of the savior, the loneliness. So I've been working with her and her family, and they actually came to the first concert we did of this material at the Baycrest Center in September of 2022. And that was extremely moving to have the generations of the family. So yeah, so it's been quite rewarding to, help share these stories, to have Molly's voice on the radio. There was a BBC story about this project, and they had a short interview with Molly. And it's been quite rewarding to be able to work with her and her family and share her amazing story and recommend her unbelievable book.
But what about children and grandchildren of the survivors who were involved with Paula's project?
Yeah, maybe Paula can speak to that more.
Short answer, no. However, as you caught, the first public performance was just last month, so that I believe there is a CD being released in January, and then I will be working in preparation for that, working with the person who took over the work that I was doing at Baycrest when I left, to try and connect with, it would be probably grandchildren and some elderly children of the initial group. The group that I was working with were in their 80s, over 30 years ago. So their children, if they are still alive, would be quite elderly today. We are going to make an effort to let them know, because I think this would be quite a gift to get this many years later.
So if the record is coming out in January, is there any way that our listeners can listen to any of this music? We'll put on a sampling on this program, but is there any way that they can listen to this, or just wait for the CD?
Yeah, well, fortunately, we've already released a number of videos, and I can share the links so that they can be on the webpage, that we have links to these songs, and they're subtitled if you don't speak Yiddish.
Okay. Is there anything else either of you would like to add that we might have left out?
You know, one thing, I wish Rebecca was here. When she was composing the music for this, she was telling me that as someone who's trained at conservatory in classical music, they studied all the great composers like Brahms, and Schubert, and Beethoven, and Haydn, and had studied how those composers were able to try to capture the broad range of human emotion and joy and sorrow and pain and all of these things, especially with stringed instruments. And she brought all of that into this, but had to deal with types of emotions that at least I hadn't heard, and I'd imagine most people hadn't heard, of the fear of a mother being separated from her children but being unable to make a sound. And to be able to draw on all of her training and all of that background in both classical and jazz and tango to try to get those emotions that, at least to my experience, hadn't really been written in music before, she just did an incredible job.
I think what strikes me about all of this is very much at this stage a passive and delighted participant in this whole project is the timelessness of these stories. Yes, it was the Holocaust, and yes, that happened some time ago, and there have been subsequent genocides, but because of the musical adaptations, because of the language evolutions involved, the story shows its universality. Their words have their universality, and there are things happening in the world today, and there are horrific things happening that have happened post-Holocaust that this music and these words speak to. And it is just a reminder that Never Again, which is the motive that drove the original group to start talking and telling their stories, is still happening again. And we have to do something to stop that and to heal the wounds that we've been inflicting ever since.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Well, that's it for this week. As always, we'd love to hear from you. So please email us any comments or suggestions or questions you'd like us to answer on the air. Our address is English Corner at RadioSephirod.com. See you next week.